Okay, thank you very much. I think that information that Wayne shared was just fantastic. Right now, there are a few questions that we have that have been submitted, and I think we can see that, is there a minimum income limit that self-employment applies to? Not being a tax person, per se, I'm not certain that I can respond to that.
This is Janie HL. Randy, if you're on the line still, that's a great question. And if you go back into Wayne's PowerPoint, he does talk about self-employment issues to a certain degree. However, and Trent is going to come on in a little bit, he can kind of reiterate this for you as well, but there is a split of opinion about these issues as they relate to self-employment tax. And as a result of that, we've got some of the individuals involved in the RuralTax.org group are going to be sending us a couple of additional slides that can really identify the split of professional opinion on how self-employment issues are dealt with in this context. And I think Randy's question is really great because it really puts in high relief the reality that when there is a split of opinion among the professional community, then it's really important and it really drives home the importance to an individual Keeps Eagle claimant that they've got to have an individual who can be their tax advisor on these issues, because if that comes into play and there is a split of, you know, professional opinion on how self-employment tax is dealt with, then you've got to have somebody sitting by your side at your elbow to help you walk through this so that if you do get questions from the IRS later, you're prepared to have somebody there who can help you through the process. But I think Randy's question is very important, and it kind of teases out the reality that we're going to be adding to these questions and answers kind of as we go, and the self-employment issue is going to be the first addition. We'll make sure that everybody who's on the Train the Trainer webinar and in our circles that are a part of this whole effort receive those additional slides as they come.
Okay, thank you, Janie. we have next a compilation of some questions and answers that were asked at the last webinar that I think are pertinent to share. And also, we have some other information that was added at a later time from questions that were submitted. I believe Janie and Trent may be both addressing these. And then later, Trent Tigerstrom will be going over some tools for management and record keeping, and take also, I believe, some open questions from those on the presentation. So if we're ready, we can begin the Keeps Eagle Tax Clinic Q&A from the original webinar.
And HL, is Trent on the line with me?
Yeah,
great, Trent. why don't I just kind of walk through these very quickly, and Trent, you just chime in where you deem appropriate. But these questions and answers, for those of you who are going to be on the ground in these clinics and be talking to people, these were pulled from the audio from other sources based on the webinar of a couple of weeks ago. And the general advice to our conveners and presenters at all these clinics, this is extremely important. We are not allowed to give individual tax advice to individual Keeps Eagle claimants. To do so would be to incur possible personal or professional liability for the actions of those Keeps Eagle claimants in reliance on your individual advice to them. Unless you're a trained tax professional working with them as a client, then we need to avoid individual tax advice at all costs. The purpose of these clinics is to get this information through the PowerPoint and the audio of, you know, the February, the webinar today and the February 8th webinar, that should be 8th, and the associated PowerPoints and the Q&As into the hands of Keeps Eagle claimants and their tax advisors so that they can take appropriate action. And so please advise folks when you're actually on the ground with people multiple times. I think it's important to bring it home at the sessions that you'll convene or take part in, that all Keeps Eagle claimants must file their tax returns as their settlement received is reportable income. And please impress upon them that they need to find a tax advisor locally to assist them. Trent, you want to weigh in here at all?
Yeah, we just want to make sure that people aren't showing up to these workshops with their tax returns and expecting you or somebody over the phone to do these taxes for them at the workshop. It's to provide the information of specific questions that might come about, more common questions, and then try to get some opinions about how those might be handled so then they could take it back to their professional.
Well, and I think this next slide really brings home what Trent just said as well. You know, tax education clinics are a common occurrence in the agriculture sector. There's even a Center for Ag Tax, and there is the Rural Tax Group that Trent and several of our professional friends are involved in that have significant technical expertise within those professional groups, and many of them are involved in these clinic efforts and in kind of peering over our shoulder or being actively engaged in all of the clinics. And they regularly provide education information, but they don't provide individual tax advice. So it kind of goes back to what HL was saying earlier. No matter what our impulses are to give people, you know, a black and white answer and clear guidance, the purpose of these clinics is to get educational information into the hands of the claimants so that they can in turn get it into the hands of their tax professional, just so that we can have at least some remote hope of consistency in how these settlements are dealt with. But it's also an opportunity, and Trent's going to go through his set of slides in a little bit, to direct them to various business management and tax management tools available to them through our normal educational avenues that we are all familiar with, but they may not be so much. And so this is all going to, we hope over time, help to build stronger, more successful farm and ranch businesses in Indian Country. So one of the first questions is, you know, who's actually teaching or convening these individual workshops? And this slide will let you walk through that, you know, it's a mix of people. It's some of our Extension Risk Management Education friends, our FERTAP friends, some of the Extension Ag Tax folks are doing it, most of our Technical Assistance Network folks with Intertribal Ag Council are actively involved. So the goal is to have a group of folks to get basic information to you and gather up questions. We know and we fully anticipate that you might receive some really strange and unusual questions in any of your clinics or in all of your clinics that you're engaged in. But we're not going to be doing individual tax returns. And what we need for you to do when you're on the ground is when you run across some question that's been posed that is something you've never seen before, and maybe it's not dealt with by the audio or any of these PowerPoints, please let us know, the team that's involved here, and we will do our best to get some consistent answers to you. One of the first questions that came up in one of the audios from a couple of weeks ago was that that somebody's tax advisor had told them that they had to deal with this Keeps Eagle settlement in their 2013 tax returns, not their fiscal year or calendar year 2012. The payment was received in 2012, and our feeling is that it should be dealt with when you file your returns for that time period. But, again, you know, there's no way of knowing how many people are going to regularly file or not. There's no way of knowing how many people seek extensions or not, and so it's very important if you receive this kind of a question to work with the tax advisors that folks have to determine, you know, when they're going to be filing their proper tax forms. Trent, you want to take this next question?
Okay, it says, why are the tax clinics being held where they are? And basically, there was the general list of individuals that received these payments. We had general clusters that we understood by the first three areas of the zip code, so we kind of had an idea of where they were at. We do not have individual names or addresses because that's all confidential and we're not going to have access to that. So then we tried to group locations, working with the IRC outreach folks as well as with the FERTEP agents and others to determine which would be the best locations and try to work together on these to really focus in on the key areas that we'd have available.
And the next question is that we received earlier is, I haven't received a USDA Farmers Project certification form. How do I get one? That came up quite a bit. It came up in you all's questions today. So, you know, the thing we're telling people is to contact the claims administrator there. That should be 1-888, I apologize for that, 233-5506. They're also linked to the telephone number on the website, IndianFarmClass.com. And it's important that heirs that are involved in any sort of estate for someone who had their claim adjudicated and they were deceased, that those forms are sought out and completed as a part of this process. Another question that came up quite frequently was, can I file again if my claim has been denied? And David Frunz dealt with this question in our previous webinar, and the answer to that is no. If the individual did not receive a payment after they filed their claim and their claim was denied, they cannot file a claim again. The denial, according to the settlement agreement, was a final, non-appealable decision, and that is a pretty absolute. It's one of the few absolute answers that we can give in this process, is that these clinics are not to solicit new claims. New claims cannot be filed. They cannot be re-adjudicated either.
Yeah, I think that's important because I think you are going to get questions out there about that, whether I can come back or not. So we need to be aware of that.
Yeah, another question that came up was a pretty specific fact situation. The father passed. There were seven heirs. Five of the heirs are filing tax returns, and two are not planning to file. What should we do? We, Trent, I think you'll confirm this, but we anticipate you might get a lot of these questions at all in the clinics as well. All of the recipients of a claims payment, either directly or through the estate of a loved one, should file. All the individuals who are planning to file should fill out, or someone needs to be filling out in the heirs group, a USDA Farmers Project certification form, again, bringing up the importance of that form. The tax payment that's been forwarded to the IRS already can then be sprinkled among the beneficiaries to the estate. But one of the questions that we had previously was, well, what if I don't know their Social Security number and I don't think I can get it because maybe they don't intend to file? And David's response to that was, fill it out the best you can, even if you don't have the Social Security numbers of some of the other heirs. It's just important to get it in. Brent, you want to take this next one?
Okay, so what about individuals received a 1099 miscellaneous but didn't receive a 1099-C but did receive debt forgiveness and relief? Okay, and the answer to this, and I think this was Wayne Hange that was addressing this question, just because you didn't receive it doesn't mean it's not taxable, okay? So you believe you've received it, or there was some proper tax forms, or maybe that you didn't receive your form yet, or maybe there's a mix-up on it, whatever there might have been, you need to, again, contact the Keith Seagull Claim Administrator, because if you did receive a payment, but not the 1099, there should be one out there. So if there is some missed information, you might want to think about calling them, as well as look at the possibility of filing a no-cost or filing an extension on this, so you can get this information straightened out and get it lined out the best you can.
Then another question that came up, I received a 1099 for an estate. The 1099 used the Social Security of the deceased, number of the deceased, and not the 1099 for the estate. The deceased passed over 10 years ago, and the heirs don't want to file tax returns. Wayne went into this, I think it was Wayne, went in quite detail in terms of the K-1 forms that are commonly used in these types of situations and the income distribution deductions that are commonly used in the state distributions. Again, the certification form comes into play here. Wayne spoke of how some states require estates be closed after a certain time. Some states allow estates to be open for many decades. And then we have the circumstances of probates that are controlled entirely by the federal government. You know, what we've got here on our hands is a mix of situations based on where you are and where the individual may live and their personal circumstances. So, again, this is one of those circumstances that just on its face is a pretty complex question. And that's why it is very, very important that the individual's tax preparer, you know, be fully aware of all of the issues that they can properly deal with you in your filings. And then the next question that we think we'll get quite a bit of is, what about an individual who's never filed taxes on ranching operations but received debt forgiveness? And Wayne, I think, also spoke to this issue as well, and maybe he really kind of very clearly got to the issue. Maybe the person never had income or expenses that were reportable. But if they received debt forgiveness and claims payment, it has to be reported. And again, yet another circumstances where it's important to drive home that they've got to check with the tax advisor. And then there was another question related to having not filed before. I've never filed before. How far back can the IRS go in determining my tax liabilities? Again, I think Wayne also answered this in the session, but we thought it'd be good to pull it out into an actual slide. You know, it becomes, again, a very personal circumstance. Do you have any income that was taxable or that should have been reported? Have you underreported your income by a certain percentage? In some cases, the IRS can go back 6 years. Some individuals may have never filed because of their income that is derived from trust lands and their farming or ranching activities that occur on those lands. Some individuals that we know of personally farm and ranch on trust lands but file. So, again, it's one of those circumstances, and I think Wayne spoke to it in his presentation, that you may want to have an explanation letter attached to the return to explain the circumstances. And if this is the first taxable income you have ever received, IRS may not go back at all, and Wayne made that comment. But again, there's no way that you, in a clinic situation or setting, can absolutely assure anybody of anything that the IRS may or may not do. So it's very important, if you receive a question like this, that you advise the person that they've got to work with a tax advisor to determine what course of action is best for that particular individual and take appropriate action. Trent, you want to take this next one?
Okay, the question came in there. It says, what do we do to get our money back from the IRS, buy a new tractor for write-off purposes? What if we have used our claim payment to purchase improvements on the farm? And we assume this one, Wayne was dealing with this one as well, and we assume this was the somebody that got the money, bought a tractor in that same year, so it would have been the last year. And what we are looking at there is, if you use this claim payment to purchase these pieces of equipment or any other thing that you're going to use on the farm or the ranch on that, but mainly this is an equipment purchases. That's what we're looking at here. You may be able to use this IRC form 179 to write off your earnings of farm and off-farm income up to $500,000, including the settlement income. So if you're buying these, there are deductions on this, and I'm going to be going over a part on this on the realtax.org where we have some information talking about that and a little more in depth on that. When you're looking at buying a piece of equipment, how much you're going to deduct in any given year, and there's different ways you can do it, and there's different rulings, but you also want to think of the cash flow implications behind that, whether you can, if it's a new piece and you can deduct the entire amount in the first year and use it against that, or if you want to do kind of prorate it out or alternative. There's different ways of handling it. There are methods of doing it, and it just depends on what you're doing, how much you want to do, but there are cash flow implications depending on which way you go with it.
This is Janie. I'm going to apologize for the siren in the background. We're having a test at this point, and I apologize if this recording picks it up. One of the other questions, I'm an elderly person. I've never filed before, and I'm not eligible for Social Security payments because I'm short three quarters. Can I use the $62,500 to qualify? And again, I think Wayne's response to that particular question was it may be that you could use this income to qualify, but again, here's one of those other circumstances that you've got to check with a tax advisor to determine how this can be reflected in order to qualify for Social Security. And then we anticipate, and Trent, chime in here if you want to, that we're going to have quite a few estate questions. And does the estate have to file on behalf of the beneficiaries? You know, and I think that the common answer for our purposes of these clinics has got to be to make sure, first and foremost, that the claims form that we've referred to many times today and in the presentations is obtained and is filled out as completely as possible. Each estate is going to be dealt with separately. Each has its own set of facts that surround it. Some individual claimants may have passed in the last few years and the estate may be open. Some estates have had a closed estate, probate process for many, many years. Some don't ever file an estate tax return based on the amount of income in the estate, or the estate was concluded very quickly. Again, every single person's circumstances are going to be different. It's almost impossible to come up with any sort of clear answer on this, but it's important for those individuals who are beneficiaries of estates that may or may not be closed that they take their form, that they make sure that they've got the form in the system, and that they take their form with these documents and with their own personal circumstances and consult either an estate's technical advisor or professional advisor to them to deal with beneficiary interests.
Yeah, and I think it's real important with that you're going to get a lot of estate questions out there. It's real important to advise, I think, is to bring up the differences that can occur in there just so they get they know the story that they have, the information that there may be required of them to the documentation needed that they can go in and not have to go back and keep looking for stuff. So it's just an individual basis, and they need to be able to figure out, tell their story so their tax professional will be able to help them more efficiently that way.
Well, and this next slide really picked up on the whole estate issues as well. My parent has been deceased for 17 years. The Keeps Eagle settlement check came in his name. None of the adult heirs could cash the check. They had to open the estate back up, name an executor, and obtain a new check. The check came in the executor's name. Who pays the taxes? The individual heirs who received their portion of the settlement will need to identify the income that they received, which is their portion. And again, that's where this certification form comes into play again, as mentioned earlier. And if you don't have one, if the individuals you're talking to don't have one, then again, have them contact or you could contact for them, but make sure that they get in contact with the claims administrator by phone or by email and get one of these forms in play in these circumstances, because again, yet another example of individual circumstances where, you know, determining who are the beneficiaries and how that income is to be properly reported is critical. Trent?
What form I received to contain an error, but I'm approaching a filing deadline. That's what we talked to, I mentioned a little bit earlier on, is that if there's any kind of errors in any of the forms on there, then we feel it's kind of critical that you go talk to the Keeps Eagle Lanes claimant administrator, try to get this straightened out, get it corrected. In some cases, they'll have to go back to where the 1099 was issued. They'll have to get that. So it's real important. Maybe the first thing that they might want to do is go down and file an extension so they can try to work on this. But it's real important to try to get this figured out and get the filings correct. So an extension could be really necessary and really critical in trying to get these minor details or these major details figured out, and there won't be any tax consequences then.
And we mentioned this before, too, but if the IRS changes its mind on taxability of this income, how will we know? And the only way we do know that we'll be able to reach out is through the Keeps Eagle Claims Administrator and the Class Council. They will do so if they hear of anything new from the IRS regarding the taxability of these claims payments. And then, in addition, all of the participating organizations in this webinar and in these clinics will post this information to the applicable websites that are all a part of this.